This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight.
Hello.
Hey. Alrighty.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Had a good Easter. You?
Yeah, it was pretty good for me. I went over to my aunt's, which is pretty much what we do every year, and she ends up cooking way, way too much food.
Yeah,
I had two helpings of everything, and boy, was that a mistake.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's pretty much what happens.
I basically had two servings of roast beef, two servings of lamb, two servings of potatoes, two servings of veggies, two servings of homemade chocolate cake because it was my cousin's birthday. And then I had, oh God, what else did I have? I had something else I'm missing, but anyways, it was a lot of food.
Wow. Yeah, I'm surprised you're still standing.
Well, I didn't have a good evening, let's just say that. I had some serious stomach issues, which kind of bled over into the following day, but I have fully recovered today.
Well, that's good. Alrighty, so we should get started. I don't know which one we want to start with. Maybe the top?
Let me look at my list here. Sure, some of the articles I haven't actually read. Like, I have not read the Bloodborne review from Polygon. But we can maybe talk about that a little bit. What else? Oh, yeah, the Tomb Raider thing. I thought that was really interesting. Let's do that first.
Yeah, so 8.5 million copies of the reboot of Tomb Raider have been sold. More than any other game in the franchise's history.
And from the sounds of it, it seems like Square Enix didn't expect that.
No, especially given the initial kind of... Well, they were hoping it would sell more than it did to start with. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And right. That sort of led them to take the deal from Microsoft to get the next Tomb Raider game exclusive to Xbox One.
I'm hoping will eventually get lifted. Like, do you think that title will come to the PS4 at some point?
I hope it will. I think at the very least we'll see it on PC, hopefully. Especially given the new integration between Xbox One and Windows 10. I mean, presumably Rise of the Tomb Raider would be a Windows 10 game running on DirectX 12, so... presumably we'll at least see it on PC. Whether it comes to PS4 is a question of the contract that Square Enix signed with Microsoft. So either it's a timed exclusive or it's a permanent exclusive. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, that still remains to this day one of my favorite games. It had such a strong impact on me. And I mean, it just, the cinematic feel of the whole game, the strong female protagonist, it was just like top to bottom. It was so polished, especially when I replayed it, on my PS4. It looked substantially better than the PS3 version. I think we've covered that a little bit in the past, but it's still such a fantastic game. And I really feel that you do get a lot of enjoyment out of replaying that game a few times over.
Oh, absolutely. Just the narrative arc that it takes. I mean, it's kind of a Batman Begins story, but just the arc from Lara being sort of this naive college student to becoming this hardened survivor becoming the Tomb Raider that we all know and love from the start of the game to the end.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just a dramatic transformation.
You know, it's just a shame. One of those things. Mm-hmm.
It's just a shame that so much of the game relied on killing enemies. There was a lot of murder involved.
There was. I mean, it. I'm getting a little tired of that as the primary sort of mechanic or reason why a character is doing something in a game. You know, it's definitely something that I feel that's a little bit tired in gaming. Though, I mean, I enjoyed the Hotline Miami games, and those games are hyper violent. But if you're able to look beyond the hyper violent aspect of it, there is kind of an interesting storyline there. But overall, I definitely think violence is like kind of the main focus of a game is dated somewhat. And let me just be clear. I don't have a problem with violence in games. In games like Wolfenstein, for example, even though you're killing Nazis, there's a really good story there, and there's a reason why you're having to kill these people, and it's not focused on the violence. It's very much focused on the people. It's a game about people. And they focused on the story quite a bit in comparison to past Wolfenstein games, which were, I mean, let's face it, they're just all mindless first-person shooters, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was quite impressed with Wolfenstein, especially the portion of the game in the concentration camp.
Yeah, the concentration camp was a particularly good scene in that game. I haven't actually played the new expansion, but I don't really feel compelled to.
I don't think it's out yet.
I saw it. I saw it advertised, and I read what it was about, but it seemed like it was just milking the franchise, because it seems less about story and just more about random. Like, it seems like it's going back to the basics of just random killing without a focus on the story.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it takes place before the game. It's kind of a prequel of sorts. It might be what happens leading up to the start of the original game, where you're storming the facility. But
I don't know. I wrote a few weeks back. I wrote an article about how I need a break from first person shooters. I just kind of feel. I just feel tired. I'm sure I'll probably come back to them at some point, but I've really been making an effort to seek out games that offer different types of gameplay that are more focused on story, that are more focused on emotional impact. You know, and one of the things that I love, it's not done often, but I really feel like the more shit that they throw at the protagonist, like the more interesting it is to me. Like just seeing the protagonist of a story kind of just go up against the weight of the world, you know, and persevering through extreme levels of hardship makes it so much more interesting to me. You know, I like it when characters are flawed. I like it when characters get beat up by, you know, especially if they're portrayed as a very heroic character. I thought that was really well done with Lara Croft in the new Tomb Raider game, because she gets hurt and she has a hard time. It's not super easy for that character in the story. You know, it's not like you're just some gun-toting heroic character who, you know, no matter what happens, they somehow always manage to get out of a difficult situation unscathed. Yeah. But it's not the case for Lara in that game. And you know, I really like it when games do that. I'm really enjoying Valiant Hearts. I don't know if you've had a chance to play that or if you're familiar with it, but I think it was free for PSN Plus members for a while, a couple months back. But anyways, it's a really interesting game. It's I think it's done by Ubisoft France. Yeah. And it's a story about World War One. So there are two things. Even though you have to kill people in the game, it's not hyper-violent. It's got a very kind of cartoony art style to it. Mm. Actually, has a very it's a very French-looking art style, which I really like. So it looks very different than a lot of American style cartoony type graphics. But it's very much, even though it is about the sorrows of war, it is very much a story about people and how people's relationships are broken up because of the horrors of war, and people die, and it's about sadness and how do you cope with this in this kind of situation. But there are light and dark aspects to the story as well. But the real cool thing about it is that you also get to learn a lot about World War One, because it has all these historical facts that you can optionally read in the game. And when you actually find kind of items just lying around in the game, you get to uncover additional historical facts. So, for example, like, you know, you might pick up a dog tag from German officer or British officer, and it'll give you facts about how it was made, and it'll talk about like all the different iterations that they went through to make the tag over the years, from 1914, 1915, 1916. So you get to learn a lot about it. So it's really interesting. And actually, I just the other day I posted a tweet about how I'm playing it, and I got a response from someone that said that their daughter really is enjoying the game. I don't know how old their daughter is, but it does seem like a game that's approachable to kids, and I would certainly let, if I had a kid, I would probably let them play it, just because it's so informational. And you get to learn a lot. It's not focused on the killing.
Yeah.
And like when you kill somebody, it's not like, it's not bloody or anything, right? So, but it strikes, I think, a good balance between story and, you know, fighting.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's mainly a puzzle game though. So a lot of the stuff that you do, it's like, you know, find a way to move this object so you can get up to this platform, for example, to pass that point that you're at. Or like you'll encounter somebody who's just like firing at you with a machine gun, and you got to figure out a way around, right? So you'll end up doing things like, one of your characters, Emil, has this shovel, and so his specialty is like digging. So you'll be able to like dig underground and then go through like all the underground trenches and stuff like that. And then you're able to like surprise your enemy by like throwing a stick of dynamite into their nest where they are, and then they don't expect it, and then the rest of your battalion or whatever is able to get through that point. So it's pretty well done game so far.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm just looking at screenshots. That looks awesome. I think it's really grabbed it before the month clicked over.
Yeah, give it a shot. It's not one of those like exceedingly long games where you have to invest 40 plus hours. I think it's about 6 hours to complete the story on average. So it's a fairly quick playthrough, but very enjoyable.
Cool.
Yeah, and you know, it's another thing with games, talking about games that focus on story and character, is that I really want to forge a relationship with the characters. I want to find characters that I can relate to. I want to be able to feel either happiness or sadness for a character. And when a game invokes those kind of emotions in me, I feel like that, okay, they've done their job. And when a game doesn't do that, it just seems completely mindless. Like, and I've played these things before. Like, if I can't feel that emotional connection, it just seems like another game that, you know, I played 15 years ago. And that's why I kind of want to slow down and take a step back from first person shooters, is because of that reason. They're all very formulaic. I haven't played Far Cry 4. And I don't know, I'm losing interest in that genre.
Yeah. I think a lot of genres could really stand to gain some emotional resonance. A lot of it is just rinse, repeat, basically designed to sell copies. It's just formulaic as hell. It doesn't take chances. Like, we have the technology now to really make games that make you think, that make you feel something.
Yeah.
Like, there are parts of Tomb Raider where you're like, oh God, how's Lara going to get out of this? Or, like, when she gets injured, you almost feel it, especially those death scenes. Like, when you fail.
Yeah.
And she falls into a spike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I read a review once of, I don't remember who wrote it, but they said that they couldn't play the game because they were horrified by the brutal death scenes. Mm. And I just feel like that's completely, you're totally A, missing out on a good story, and B, you're overlooking the entire point of the game. The death scenes are brutal, not because they just want the character to suffer, but it's to show you that you're in a particularly dangerous situation and your life is in danger. And if you screw up, your life is done. It's not, you know, they want to make you feel something. It's not like, oh, I got shot in the face, but I don't see it and I just respawn. Like,
yeah.
There's no emotional impact with
death
that.
Death needs to have a consequence.
Exactly.
And since you can just reload the checkpoint, they need to give it something.
Yeah, something to weigh it down in reality that, yes, I know I'm playing a video game, but I want to be reminded that there are consequences to actions that have, you know, if I do something wrong, there's a negative outcome, and I need to be able to feel that negative outcome so that I don't make that again. It has to resonate, I feel, with the player. Yeah. I mean, to me, games are no different than any other kind of storytelling. It's a wasted opportunity not to tell a compelling story. And I don't care if it's a first-person shooter or an RPG or whatever genre, but there are too many genres that are just formulaic, that we get the same type of game over and over and over again with absolutely no innovation. And no, I'm sorry, graphics... improving graphics are fine and people expect that, but to me the true innovation is finding a way to inject something that's fresh in that genre that we haven't necessarily seen before, or just pushing it a little bit further. You know, I'm fine with a first-person shooter as long as you make it a story about people. Make me care about the characters. Mm. Or make me hate that character, but make me feel something. And that's what's missing in a lot of games.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, actually, it's kind of like Bloodborne. If we want to segue to Bloodborne.
let's do it. Now, I have not played it, but I've watched enough people play it on Twitch and stuff like that to get a sense of what it is about. So I don't really want to form an opinion until I play that game, but I know it's been interesting seeing people's reactions to this game, because it was so well reviewed by so many well-respected websites that cover this kind of stuff. And of course they're all dudes, which is a whole nother issue. But anyway, It's received as a really well done game. But I've heard conflicting opinions from people. So there are the people that have played some of the Dark Souls games that really like this level of complexity and consequences to, it's merciless. So if you're not sharp enough, you're going to end up dying a lot in this game. What I haven't heard yet, and again, I haven't played it, is the thing that's most interesting for me to find out is, what are these characters doing in the game? What is their motivation? What compels them to do something? What moves the story and the narrative forward? I haven't really heard much about that. So I'm curious to know what you think about this.
Well, I can tell you right off the bat, the story is almost not there. Dark Souls games tend to be very obfuscated. The story is sort of there, but you have to go looking for it. Basically, at the start of the game, you have this premise that you've come to the city looking for the magical healing powers mm-hmm. that the city has. But it turns out that everything has gone horribly wrong, and everyone in the city is either hiding or has been turned into a monster or a crazed madman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks very nightmarish.
Yeah. And it seems to be always nighttime. So a night that never ends, filled with monsters. Mm-hmm. But that's really all you have to go on. You're in sure. this place, and now, you can't leave until you've either, presumably, until you've killed all the monsters, I guess.
So, all I can say is from what I've seen, it seems intentional with the whole nightmarish vibe. They're trying to, I guess for what they lack maybe in story and character development, they're trying to invoke certain types of emotions that are not necessarily related to the individual characters, but they want you to feel a certain something by being in that environment, right? By being surrounded by darkness, by being surrounded by hordes of, unholy creatures. So I get that, but I don't know. For me, that just doesn't seem, it's not enough for me. And it's totally fine if people are enjoying Bloodborne. Like I said, I still haven't played it. I probably will have to get to it at some point. But if that's all there is to it, I don't know. That just doesn't seem that interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean...
It's got a really long... I mean, it takes more than 30 hours to complete the story, the main story, right?
Yeah, something like that. And that's not including all the times that you're going to die.
Huh. And I've heard other people talk about how they get really frustrated because it's very easy to get lost in the game. And there's nothing that really helps you kind of figure out what to do next.
Yeah, that's also true.
That doesn't seem...
It's
right to me.
A lot of the game feels difficult for the sake of being difficult. It's like, you're this guy, there's no map, because the guy doesn't have a map. And there's no signs or anything. They're kind of going for sort of this brutal realism, where it's like,
right.
you end up
right.
in the city, you don't know, like, you're a stranger to this place. So you don't know where anything is. So naturally you don't have a map. But that makes it a bit difficult for people to play through.
Right. Well, at least they bothered to include the ability to create a female character.
Yes. That is certainly progress, at least.
The character creator looks pretty impressive in that game.
Yeah, you can tweak quite a lot in there. I didn't spend a ton of time on it. I just kind of tweaked it to what I was okay with. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the time, your character's face is obscured anyways, because the sure. hunter costume is kind of this trench coat with sort of a mask that pulls up and a hat. So... usually your features are obscured. It's kind of lightweight armor to protect you against the various gore and viscera that inevitably end up coating you.
Right. Do you know how much time you've invested in this game?
I've maybe sunk 3 or 4 hours into it so far.
Okay.
I've died about maybe 20 times. And
do you feel that, and I realize that's not a lot of time to kind of get into this game, but do you feel like you care about what's going on in that world?
in that I care what's going to happen, I don't think so. But the atmosphere is certainly compelling, and the setting is certainly intriguing. Like, you kind of want to continue through the game to find out exactly what's going on and how things got this way. Because you're kind of thrown in without any real idea of what's going on. You just sort of end up in this hospital room, and this guy tells you, like, he gives you a transfusion, and there's, like, some explanation of what's happening, and then you're just sort of left to fend for yourself.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to give it a shot. Maybe we can come back to this once both of us have spent some considerable time and can form a better opinion about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun. It's definitely fun, but also really difficult. Like, it's certainly not going to be accessible to casual players or...
Sure. Well, I don't think that's their audience. And that's fine. You know, the difficult... I know a lot of people have been getting on the game's case about the difficulty. I think that's less of an issue to me. Like, I need a reason to want to repeatedly play through this to get to whatever the next objective is, right? I mean, just look at Hotline Miami. I mean, that game was intentionally made to be ridiculously hard. You die like a thousand times before you get to do it. Like, some levels, I spent like 3-4 hours one time on some of the more difficult levels in the sequel, which, by the way, the sequel is even more difficult than the first one. And you die so quickly, like, you can't dodge things. Like, if you're not super precise, you will die. And there's certain things like the attack dogs in that game. Like, there's just no way you'll survive if you don't shoot the dog before it sees you. It just moves so quickly. Like, the attack dog is able to, like, move from one corner of the map to the other corner of the map where you are in like a split second. So it's not meant to be realistic, but it's meant to really challenge the player to be really careful and look at the map carefully and look at where all the guys are situated on the map and figure out, well, how many people are on here? And, you know, if I go this way, you know, what are the chances of surviving? You know, well, I should take these two guys out before taking the next two out, kind of a thing. Like, you have to do it in a specific way in order to progress through. And that was fine. I liked the challenge of that as well. But again, the story has to be supporting that. And otherwise, if it's just difficult for the sake of being difficult and you've got no story to make me care about it, then there's no point in me playing your game.
Yeah. That's always the tricky thing. And a lot of developers don't seem to understand that. It's like, well, we just have this challenging game and you have to be a tough, hardcore gamer to be able to play it.
Right.
Like, you're intentionally denying accessibility.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said for, okay, sure, make a game that's difficult, but at the same time, you don't want to push away people who might have played your game, but now won't.
Right.
Because it's impossible.
Well,
for
that's the thing. And, you know, there's this this trend now also from indie developers to release these very nostalgic, you know, 8-bit retro games. And I'm fine with that. Some of them are done really well. Some of them not done so well. But I feel like, if the main selling point of your game is we're going to reduce the amount of save points and make it stupidly difficult for the sake of making a game that is exactly like something you would have played in 1985, that doesn't make sense. Like, guys, we got to move this genre forward because in 1985, you had technical limitations. You didn't, like, have onboard storage on the Nintendo NES, like, where you could just have these save points automatically so that you wouldn't have to redo an entire level. We don't need to go back to that. That's taking a step back. Like, I'm fine with retro looking games as long as we take some of the elements and technology we have now and incorporate that into the game. I think one game that does this exceedingly well is Retro City Rampage. Because it's got the old school graphics, but you have save points, and they've done things to make it a little bit more modern in that sense. So it's not as frustrating as something you would have played 30 years ago. I don't know. Have you actually played 1001 Spice? I was just reading about that game recently. I haven't actually tried it. But the main selling point to that game is that it's incredibly difficult. And to me, that's just not enough for me to really want to play it.
Yeah. That to me is just not a selling point. I mean, I've always,
like, there's no story. There's barely any story in that game. And it's like, okay, this is a game where you literally will die 1,000 times before you get to the next point in the game. So I that's uninteresting.
Yeah. I mean, I would say my entire history of being a gamer, I've always really appreciated story, and that's why I tend to buy games that reflect that most of the time. I mean, I've bought, that's why I think I skew a lot towards RPGs, because they're usually all about the story.
Right.
Like, they'll usually have similar gameplay, like leveling up, getting better weapons and so on. But the real focus will be this world and these characters and the story, because that gives you the reason to keep going in the face of kind of more generic gameplay.
Exactly.
So, I mean, games like Xenoblade Chronicles and Knights of the Old Republic, Mass Effect, even if we ignore the third one. Like, these are the games that keep you playing, because you want to find out what happens.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not a huge RPG fan, but the few that I've played, definitely Knights of the Old Republic is up there.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's probably one of the best Star Wars stories of all time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the twist, devastating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great game, and anyone who has not played that game should definitely play it, considering now it's been remastered.
Yep.
A few times. They released it on the Mac App Store, so
it's even on iPad.
It's worth your while to play it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. In fact, actually, it's probably time for me to replay that game, because I originally played the PC version when it first came out, so I have not played it since.
I think what platform? I think I got it for Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
Was it on the original Xbox?
I'll have to check. I don't remember if they ever released it on PSN.
Yeah, I don't think they did.
Yeah, that's a shame. They really should.
Yeah.
Speaking of difficult games, there is a fantastic new documentary on Netflix called Atari Game Over. And it's a little bit about Atari's history and their kind of rise to power and fall shortly after, but also very much about the whole mythology of the famously number one worst made game, which is E.T., and how there, you know, people speculated for years that Atari buried millions of cartridges that they weren't able to sell. So this whole documentary is kind of about that and trying to find out if there's any truth to that. I won't spoil it, but you get to find out what happens. And it's actually directed by Zach Penn, who, for those not familiar with him, he's quite the gamer himself, and he's also fairly heavily entrenched in the whole comic book world as well. He's written, I think at least one or two X-Men movies. He's done some pretty bad movies, though. I mean, I was not a fan of his Fantastic Four movies. But regardless, he's definitely a video game nerd. I definitely learned some things about the E.T. game. Like, I've never played it, but one of the most fascinating aspects I took away from the documentary was that there are so many people that say E.T. was the worst game, even though they had never actually played it. And from some of the people they interviewed in this documentary, they said that the game was, it wasn't necessarily bad. It was just brutally difficult. And also you have to consider the fact that the guy that made the game was given 5 weeks to complete it. So considering that, a lot of people feel strongly that it's far from the worst game. In fact, a lot of people say that there are other games Atari released that were much worse than E.T. So that kind of opened my eyes to it. And I think that's fascinating. You know, it's something that I think that story is analogous to a lot of other situations where people, something becomes popular and people just hate it for the fact that other people have said it's not good, and then, but they don't actually have any experience with it. So, it's interesting how that kind of thing happens.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, almost no one would have played it.
Right.
But I don't know. I would say Superman 64 is probably a worse game. And I played that.
I haven't played it. What platform was that? Okay. Well, you know, a lot of video games that have been made from movies, yeah, they're not
well,
so
great. Well, it wasn't even made from a movie. They just kind of came up with this story that I think was based on hardware limitations. Basically, Lex Luthor trapped Superman in a virtual reality covered in green kryptonite fog.
That sounds terrible.
So draw distance limitations. And a lot of the game involved these terrible races flying through rings and really clunky combat.
Yeah, that really truly sounds awful.
And a ton of bugs where Superman would end up clipping through the level.
Yeah, that was pretty common, though.
Yeah.
Games. I know a lot of PC games I've played.
This would happen, like, almost every time, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be one of those types of games where they had a very small development window to make it and rushed it out because they wanted to meet some holiday deadline or whatever.
Oh, probably. But
and of course, because back then we didn't have, you know, internet connected boxes, there's no way to patch that thing once it's released.
Especially because it was a cartridge. Of course, now 3DS cartridge games can get updated, but that's by storing patches on the actual console.
Sure.
But, that was not a good game.
So now that Star Wars is kind of coming back into the limelight, the entire six movie series is being digitally released. Now, I'm gonna assume that it is the remastered, at least for episodes 4, 5, and 6, that those are the Tinker George Lucas.
I would assume so.
Which I would be very disappointed if they.
I would assume so. I would also assume that Disney is working on an original remaster, because I feel
it would be perfect to re-release those in the theater, right? Completely unmessed up versions, just cleanly remastered, clean up the film or whatever, but you know, give us the original versions and get people back into theaters again to watch those.
Yeah. I honestly, if I were Disney, I would probably hire the guys that have done the despecialized versions, because they've already done a lot of the grunt work and found all of these old reels and painstakingly restored them. So, I mean, with Disney's resources and their knowledge and ability, we could end up with something really special getting released.
Well, you know what would be fantastic, and I would totally commit to doing this, is right for the time when Episode 7 comes out, if they re-released Episodes 4, 5, and 6 in the theater, remastered as the original versions, and you could do like a movie marathon day where you see episodes 4, 5, 6, and 7 all together. That would be really awesome.
Yeah. If they announced that, I would just start throwing money at Disney.
Yeah. Yeah, like charge like 50, 60 bucks or whatever for the ticket, and then you're there for the entire day at the theater.
I would buy that.
Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you there'd be lineups to see that.
Oh, yeah. The theater where they show that would probably be booked up for weeks, I would think.
Yeah. And it could be like an IMAX release. How awesome would that be?
My wallet is crying. I don't even know if you could remaster it for IMAX, though. Although, I guess if
I don't know. I mean,
if they still had the original 4K, although it depends if it was shot in 4K. I guess it would depend on that.
If they had a way to make it work, that would just be amazing.
Yeah, that Star Destroyer episode 4 just. That would be something.
Yeah. And speaking of movies, there was an interesting article from Netflix. I haven't actually finished it in its entirety yet, but it's called Extracting Contextual Information from Video Assets. It's a pretty nerdy article, but if you're kind of fascinated by stuff like that, I would recommend checking it out. It's really cool how they're able to grab that data and actually show it and display it at the end sequence as like the preview,
cool.
when you finish playing something. I didn't realize that they actually have like algorithms to do this stuff and detect those keyframes.
Well, I suppose you'd have to, especially when your media changes so often, because otherwise it would be like,
right. You wouldn't want a human being having to like do this.
You would need
every
to like
single
you would
piece
need
of
like Amazon Mechanical Turk. Go watch this film and tell us what timestamp the title credits start at.
Exactly.
Times 5,000.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Yeah, I really like when Netflix does do these occasional technical posts. They don't do it very often, but it's cool that they're able to share that kind of information. Yeah. And, you know, actually, one thing that I was exploring recently, not that I'm in the market for it just yet, but I periodically check on how the 4K TV market is doing just to see what the current generation of 4K TVs offer. And it's great being able to see the 4K TV prices drop every year now with the introduction of the 2015 models that have come in. And, there's an article here that I found about it just lists all the current 4K TVs from Samsung, both the standard and their curved UHD TVs, which are just amazing. If you haven't seen one in person, they're phenomenal. I wish I could afford one, but it's great. Some of the stuff that these TVs are able to do, like the high dynamic range and the edge dimming that they're able to get on these super thin TVs with like almost no bezel, just like edge to edge glass. It's pretty incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I suspect in a couple of years, I might be ready for a 4K TV, but, they've got a dip below $2,000. Right now to get like a 60 inch 4K TV, it's still pretty expensive.
Not bad pricing towards the low end, actually.
Yeah, for the non-curved screen, it's getting closer to kind of attainable for more people, for sure.
Yeah, 827 for a 40-inch. And it's weird that they're skewing towards these larger sizes. Like, honestly, 40, 48 is probably enough for most people's living rooms.
That's true.
And yet, they're going up.
For me, though.
They're going up to, like...
I got a 51.
They're going up to 75, though. Like, who's going to use a 75-inch television?
That's true. Well, that's definitely a much smaller market, for sure. I know for me, I have a 51-inch, and I know if I were to buy a new TV today, I would not go smaller than 60-inch. For me, like, the bigger TV I can afford, the better. 40 inches is just way too small.
Do you find you have to sit back further?
Well, I already sit back pretty far anyways. My living room's pretty big, so it's not an issue for me. And I don't share in my apartment with anybody, so... But I totally understand, though, there are a lot of people that have limited room. And if you're living with roommates and you don't have a lot of space, trying to have a 50-60-inch TV can get a bit unwieldy.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to have other home theater equipment, plus game consoles. Like, I've got a receiver, I've got big Klipsch tower speakers. I need to be able to fit all that stuff. I don't know if I would ever go bigger than 70 inches. I would probably have to move into a house to really be able to justify. Like, maybe if I had a house with a basement that I could dedicate as my entertainment room, then I get like a 75-inch TV. But I think 60 inches for me now is the sweet spot. And I still prefer plasma TVs.
Yeah.
Although they're getting much more rare to find now. It used to be that I could walk into like a Best Buy and you'd still be able to have a decent selection of plasma TVs. But now I go in there, I don't even think I saw a single plasma TV the last time I went in.
Yeah, they're pretty much a dying breed. Although I would say OLED is probably pretty close to achieving the same black levels.
Yeah. It's definitely come a long way. I mean, I don't think I would ever go... Oh, well, I can definitely say I would never, ever buy a standard LED TV. It would have to be like an OLED display or one of those new Samsung UHD TVs, which have a much better contrast ratio, much better deeper blacks, deeper whites. But yeah, standard LED TV is just not good enough for that.
Yeah.
And some interesting things going on with Apple, not to kind of linger on the tech stuff too much, but, you know, we talked about this in the past before about how terrible the search algorithm is in the App Store, but it looks like Apple is maybe trying to make a serious effort to fix this now by acquiring other companies.
Yes, the retroactive discovery that, Apple had purchased a company called AutoCAD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not familiar with their product.
So AutoCAD made a sort of App Store search engine that let you filter through certain categories to make it...
It's just a web app,
was,
right?
Yeah. It kind of made it easier to filter down through particular categories of app to find what you were looking for or to discover new apps. So Apple bought them in 2013, and then about a year later, in iOS 7, I guess, they launched the Explore tab on the App Store, which does pretty much the same thing. So you can look through a list of categories, tap on a category, and it shows you the favorite apps for that category. So, for example... education or games or health. And you can see what people are downloading in those particular categories, as well as filter down even further to various subcategories. It's just a different way of looking at the App Store.
Right.
To hopefully try and find some new stuff that you might not have found otherwise.
I don't use the search feature that often because I'm just not buying or even downloading a lot of apps like I used to. But I do know that it is a serious problem that definitely needs to be fixed, especially... it's from two ends, really. From the consumer's perspective, they can't necessarily find what they're really looking for easily. And from the developer's perspective... it's really difficult because there are so many scummy apps that try to use SEO and flat out rip off icons to make them look similar to other legitimate apps. And that person may be looking for the legitimate app, but then they'll end up downloading some fake copycat version, and then they'll end up complaining and to the developers of the real app that they were looking for, thinking that that was the real app. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's a real mess for a lot of developers.
Yeah, a lot still needs to be done.
Well, I'm hoping iOS 9 will have some of those things built in. And I know people keep talking about how iOS 9 is supposed to be like the Snow Leopard version of iOS, where they're just going back and really fixing a lot of bugs and cleaning stuff up. And I'm hoping it's going to be that kind of release, but because, man, iOS 8 and even iOS 7, not the most stable versions of iOS we've had.
No. And I feel like largely that's because they've really been rushing to kind of get these major changes done. Like, iOS 7 completely changed the UI. Killed all the Corinthian leather and the gloss. Destroyed it. The green felt. Destroyed all of that. Burned it away and replaced it with what we have now. So that was major change number one. And then in iOS 8, major change number two, all of a sudden, developers have all of these new APIs and new powers, extensions. We have Handoff that lets us send stuff back and forth between our various devices. We have Continuity that lets us answer calls from our iPhone on our Mac or our iPad. So they're just adding all of these things in a very short order. And I feel like that was kind of the focus for the entire iOS team versus...
Right. Like we're probably not going to get like another major release of iOS with something as massive as like Handoff, for example.
No. I think this year they're saying, okay, we've gotten all of the crazy stuff we wanted to get in. So now let's just take a little step back and try and fix everything and get it back up to the standard that we normally adhere to. There will be some new features. We know that there is probably going to be a major update to maps, for example. They're finally going to add transit directions back. And hopefully bring it up to a level where somebody could theoretically use it instead of Google Maps. I'll still be using Google Maps, but...
I don't understand that. Apple Maps for me is fine. Like, Google Maps takes longer to launch from a cold start, and Apple Maps is more responsive to me, and I get my transit stuff from the transit app, so...
True.
I mean, is it just that you're kind of used to Google Maps, so you keep using it? Because I've never had it issue. At least in the last year or two, I haven't really had major issues with directions or anything like that.
Yeah, for me, I just like to look up transit directions to places. I'm not kind of used to using the transit app for it, so my kind of go-to for that is Google Maps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Google Maps is fine, don't get me wrong. But, I don't know, for me, I never really had major issues with Apple Maps from the get-go, and certainly it has gotten... I feel like it's gotten better, seems to have gotten better over the last few years or however long it's been out now. I just felt like I need to use this. I need to make an effort to use Apple Maps because I know the more data I give them, the better it's going to get.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I'm just being stubborn. I think once they add transit back, I'll probably use it as my default again. I think that just really rubbed me the wrong way. They're like, oh, we're making this new Maps app. What about transit directions? Oh, you'll have to find a different app. And then when you search for transit directions, we'll open that other app. Okay.
Well, you know, the guys that make the transit app now have an Apple Watch app.
They do, and it looks very fancy. And I'm looking forward to using it.
It looks very slick. Yeah. Did you decide what Apple Watch you're getting?
Oh, yeah. I've already decided I am going to get the 42mm steel with a black sport band. Cheap one.
Fancy. Is that the...
That's the cheapest steel.
Plastic
that's,
one?
So that's the cheapest steel one. And then I'm planning to later on, probably on my next paycheck or something, get either the classic buckle or the Milanese loop.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the math. It actually turns out to be slightly cheaper if you do it that way versus buying one with a fancier band straight away and then buying a sport band additionally. I don't know why. It's just something with the prices. It's like they weight the prices a little more or a little less depending on what band you buy it with. So by buying additional bands, it ends up working out to be a little cheaper. So,
you know, I've seen some complaints from guys that have said they will not buy a Milanese loop because those types of straps tend to be arm hair. They tend to catch your arm hair and pull on.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
And I have a solution for this though. Yeah, it's amazing. It's called shaving your arm.
Yeah. But, you know, guys don't want to do that. It's not manly.
But it's if you're going to wear a watch every day, at least just shave the spot where the watch sits on your wrist.
It's not entirely unreasonable.
No one will be able to tell. No one will be able to tell. You'll be naked if you take the watch off, but you'd never do that in public. I'm not trying to be funny. I am serious. Shave your goddamn wrist.
Yeah.
If you have that much hair.
Though, that it is entirely possible that the Milanese loop doesn't catch on arm hair.
Yeah.
Like, to me, the mesh looks fairly soft.
It's tightly braided, right?
Tightly braided. So,
yeah.
Like, it's a very smooth, polished steel wire. Mm-hmm. It's not... There's no hard edges.
Well, Johnny Yav's got some arm hair, so I'm sure he probably
and,
thought about that.
Mark Newson as well, and he's been cited wearing the Milanese loop. So if it's not a problem for him,
right?
I mean, presumably they thought of this. So
I'm sure they
did. What about the link bracelet? If anything is going to catch on arm hair, that will, because that has these perfectly machined lines and gaps. So
you're getting the black strap. Is that just a style preference? You tend to like those
no,
straps?
No, that's basically just to get the cheapest steel one. Later, like a week or two later, I'm going to get a different band. I can survive on the rubber band for a week or two.
Sure. I've never found plastic straps that great, mainly because of... They don't last very long in that they after about a year of just the perspiration buildup on those straps, they start to not smell very good. And John Syracuse made a comment about that on ATP about his wife's rubber strap that smells bad after like a year of use. And that's totally normal. That's what happens with sweat.
Yeah.
It ruins the
plastic.
Well,
the thing about this band, it's made of fluoroelastomer, which...
Yeah, what is that? People keep saying that word, and I don't know what the hell that means.
So it's a specific type of polymer. And it's... Depending on the formulation, it can be used for different things. This particular formulation is likely sealed, so completely water, sweat, and weather resistant. So in theory, it should be able to hold up to wearing it all the time. Obviously, we won't know until someone's worn it for a year, but... should be okay, I think.
We'll see.
But yeah, the steel bands obviously will hold up a lot better. In theory. because they're made out of the same marine steel, surgical steel that the watch is made of.
Yeah. Well, I'm very much excited to live vicariously through you because I won't be buying this watch when it comes out.
Well, don't worry. I guess our next episode I will have try-on impressions because by then I'll have probably gone to an Apple store and had my try-on appointment.
When are they actually being released
on the 24th, but in order to get one on the 24th, you do have to actually either pre-order one on the store or walk into an Apple store beforehand, have a try-on, and then ask to reserve one. They won't be selling them to people that just walk in on the 24th.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable, considering that I think they're trying to treat the shopping experience a little bit more like buying a piece of jewelry.
I mean, that's exactly what it is.
Like, and not just any jewelry, like a higher-end piece of jewelry.
That's pretty much exactly how they're treating it. And they're sort of changing the entire store to suit that. Like, the display case that the watches are going to be in is like this special custom design thing where the sides kind of magically lift down and the employee can just grab one. And they're changing all of the uniforms for the Apple Store employees. They're now going to be wearing these very dark navy polo shirts with a smaller Apple logo just above the left breast.
Is that just for Apple Watch salespeople, or is that like a general, they're changing the uniforms for all Apple stores?
I think it's general. So they're kind of moving to this more upscale sort of look. And I would attribute that entirely to Angela Ahrens.
I was just going to say that. That totally sounds like something she would do.
Because, I mean, now they're selling these higher-end products. They're selling a $17,000 gold watch, for God's sakes. So they do need to look a little more presentable than the current Apple Genius look. I'm not sure what other major changes they're going to be making to the stores. Obviously, there's that new, very nice, high-res product imagery around the stores.
Sure. Yeah, I love what they're doing with the panoramic, like, billboard size. Well, as close as you can get to billboard-sized photos in the store. Those are pretty nice.
Yeah. And then Mark Gurman over at 9to5 Mac confirmed the display for the Apple Watch. They're apparently going to be putting all of these circular LED panels on the storefronts to emulate the home screen of the Apple Watch. So those will like change color and do all these other sorts of things, maybe display app logos, almost as if you're looking at the watch face. So that should be pretty interesting to see.
And, you know who's not going to be buying an Apple Watch? Deadpool. Ah,
yes. Yes, the Merc with a Mouth has begun filming in Vancouver.
Indeed.
They closed off the entire viaduct to film a scene the other day.
And it looks like Ryan Reynolds has slimmed down a little bit for this role. He's still in, like, good shape, but he's not as, like, big and bulky as he was in the past.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's Deadpool's build. He's more slight.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. It makes sense for the character, for sure.
Yeah.
Did you see the April Fool's video that they did with him on... what's the actor's name that played Slater on... Save the Bell. Oh. Can't remember.
That guy.
Anyways, it was an interview with that guy. And then Deadpool just shows up behind him and ends up smashing a lighting fixture or something like that over his head. It was great. It was just perfect. I just feel like that really gives me hope for them to be able to capture the look, especially after
all the speculation that they would be seeking a PG-13 and then April Fool's Day. The whole thing is like, Ryan Reynolds, isn't it great that it's rated PG-13? Such a family-friendly movie, and And Ryan Reynolds is like, it's not what we're going for. And he's like, all right, Mario Lopez. Mm-hmm. And he's just going like, right. Oh, yeah, it's great. And the Deadpool's just like, no, it's rated
I'm looking
R.
Forward to break. I'm looking forward to him breaking the fourth
wall. Oh, God, there's going to be so much fourth wall breakage. Mm-hmm. And this means you, listeners.
Do you think he'll make a reference to the like, kind of non-canon version of Deadpool from the Wolverine
Origins totally.
Movie?
They have to do that.
Like, that would be priceless.
Like, if they're totally going to do that, but if they do that, it's going to be the best.
They should make some comment about how that version of Deadpool looked like Baraka from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
I don't know if they can say that. They'd have to get permission to do it, but that would be funny.
That would be good.
He really did. I mean, that Deadpool
it was a mess.
Character, it could not be... I mean, other than the name, there is no resemblance to that comic book character.
Like, I mean, the flashback version of Wade Wilson in the movie was good. Like, Ryan Reynolds actually playing Wade Wilson was great.
Yeah, but
then they ruined it at the end, like, oh, now we're going to make him this crazy experiment and call him Deadpool for reasons.
Well, that whole movie was really terrible. The whole notion that Wolverine lost his memories because of that.
Oh, God, let's not even go there.
Come on. It was just awful. Not only have you ruined it, like you had the source material from the comic and you totally messed it up.
We could have a whole episode on how bad that movie was.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the Wolverine is not much better. They just totally destroyed Silver Samurai.
That was bad.
Let's put a guy in a robot suit, use CG. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Since when have they ever addressed this in the comic that heated adamantium can cut adamantium? I don't ever remember
that whole
being
thing was not a thing. That is just not true at all.
Yeah.
Once it's cold, adamantium is the toughest substance. Well, actually, no. It can't cut vibranium. But,
right. Yeah, those two things are fairly on par. Yeah.
Vibranium is tougher, though.
Is it?
Wolverine can't cut Captain America's shield.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So, on that note...
Well, maybe three times... I was just going to say before we wrap that maybe three times the charm will be right for, because I know Hugh Jackman plans to do at least
one more,
another Wolverine.
I think he said
movie,
the next
right?
one is so, the last one for him. So,
yeah. Well, he said, I don't know if it's that the studios don't want him anymore or because he said on numerous occasions that he will play that character until they take it away from him. Right. Like, they could do... I would love to see, like, an old man Logan story or something. Like, it doesn't even have to tie in with the other movies. Just make the standalone movie.
Yeah, I could see that. That might be cool. If he's only going to do one more...
The actor is aging. Like, Hugh Jackman is now, like, since the first X-Men movie. Like, I think he was, like... He was really young in the first X-Men movie. Like, when I go back and look at him, I'm like, oh, he looks so baby-faced. He's like 31, I think, or 32 in that movie. And now he's like in his mid-40s, right? So just, I mean, he still looks good. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, you know, I don't know. Just give him a touch of gray hair and do the old man Logan story.
I mean, if he's only going to do one more film, that should be the film, I think.
Yeah.
It would be a good story.
Yeah, I'm fine. It doesn't have to be a movie that ties in with the other.
Well, I don't think it would anyways, because after Days of Future Past, I mean, we're not really going to see him anymore. We're focusing on the kid X-Men timeline.
And I guess it was intentional on Bryan Singer's part, but they never really... I guess he's not considering... the Wolverine canonical, because at the end of that movie he had bone claws and then suddenly he's got adamantium again. And
I think
remember he got the claws chopped off in the Wolverine
and then at the end of that film he met Magneto. So
yeah,
I think that's canon. I just think by the time of Days of Future Past, he somehow got the adamantium claws back. It was just never explained how.
Yeah. Right. Well, it was never explained. I know in the comics they after Wolverine lost his adamantium, they did this whole storyline where Professor X tried to like replicate the Weapon X program thing to try to get the adamantium back. And I think the first time it rejected, and then they had like several failed attempts where they couldn't do it. And then I think then eventually he does get it back. I don't remember all the details about it.
Yeah, something like that.
I don't know how he could withstand that though, considering, I mean, cause it's his healing abilities were the only thing that kept him alive during that procedure. So to do it again, I mean, that's like such a toll for his body to actually go through that again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway. Well, at least we have the new Age of Ultron movie coming out. I think that's the only Marvel movie coming out this year? Or do we have there's the fan? Okay. What about the new Fantastic Four movies?
That's Fox, I believe. And okay. Yeah, that's coming out this year as well.
Yeah, let's see if they manage to not screw that up.
Come on, well, I mean, if they totally stick with the Doctor Doom being a blogger, yeah. If that's still the story.
Wait, a blogger?
So there was a script leak a while ago. I know how reliable these are, but apparently Dr. Doom became Victor Domashev, an online blogger from... I wish I were. I really wish I were, but that was apparently the direction they were going in. Whether that's still true, I don't know. Hopefully not, but we'll see.
I'm starting to get depressed. I was excited about upcoming movies, and yeah, not so much now with the Fantastic Four thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I really hope that's not the case, but we'll see.
You want to put a cap on it?
We will call it a day now. That's everything from us today. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us. Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at TheImpromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener-supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.